Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is hour number two of our show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Some of the most difficult questions rising out of the struggle against international terrorism concern interrogation techniques. Stated simply, how do we draw that line between physical coercion that we can live with and torture? In this part of the program, we'll be talking with Malcolm Nance. He is a 25-year veteran of the U.S. intelligence community's combating terrorism program. He is a combat veteran. He's a retired chief petty officer in the Navy. He served as an intelligence collections operator, as a cryptologist and interrogator. Today, he's director of Special Readiness Services International. That's a Washington, D.C.-based anti-terrorism, counterterrorism consultancy that supports the intelligence community. And among other things during his career, he was an instructor at the Navy's Survival School, and his job, among other things, involved preparing men and women for what they might encounter as prisoners of war, including the much-debated technique known as waterboarding. And perhaps you heard him or read some of his testimony a little earlier this month when he appeared before Congress, when he said very clearly that he believed, and it was based on his personal experience, that waterboarding was torture and that torture didn't work and should not be used by the United States. As we talk in this part of Focus 580 with Malcolm Nance, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. All we ask of people who call in is that they're brief, and we ask that so that we could keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible, but certainly people who are listening are welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line, and so if it would be a long-distance call, and if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or if you might happen to be listening on the Internet, certainly your questions are welcome. And you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. At any point here, your questions are welcome. Mr. Nance, hello.
Hello, good afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Certainly appreciate it.
Just to start out here, maybe we could explain, or I could ask you to explain just how it is you happened to be called to testify on Capitol Hill on this particular subject.
Well, quite surprisingly, it all started with an article that I wrote, a blog entry, actually. I'm one of the few bloggers on a very small esoteric military scholars website called Small Wars Journal, which is was created by two Marine colonels, who one of whom teaches at the Marine Corps University in Quantico, Virginia. And I've written two books, one on terrorist intelligence recognition and the other on the strategy and tactics of the Iraq insurgency. But we usually talk about those subjects. And one day when I was actually on my way to Sri Lanka last month, I saw a video clip of a news program from MSNBC where the announcer, Joe Scarborough, was talking about waterboarding being being debatable as to whether it was torture or not. And when he got to the comment that it was no more harsh than a fraternity prank, that's when I opened my laptop and I banged out what now appears to be an angry missive. But what it really is from an intelligence officer's perspective, someone who's gone through these procedures, who had to do these procedures on hundreds of people, I wanted to make it very, very clear to the military community that waterboarding was torture. And somehow it made its way to the press, and from there I was asked to testify before Congress.
Yeah. And just again here to be clear that this was your experience with this had to do with your involvement with the Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape program in the Navy, where what you were doing was you were trying to give service people the experience to prepare them for what might happen to them if they were taken as a prisoner of war or they were taken hostage. And as a part of that training, you put people through this. And in fact, you've been waterboarded yourself.
Yes, it's true. That's exactly right, the way that you described it. As a SEER instructor, that's S-E-R-E, it was my job to inoculate, so to speak, high risk of capture military people, mainly pilots and special operations people like SEALs and Marine reconnaissance personnel, and to give them a taste of what it would be like to to fall into the hands of a totalitarian evil nation with a complete disregard for human rights and Geneva Convention. And our schools are the collective embodiment of 50 years of training and over 200 years of knowledge of the trials and tribulations of U.S. service members and civilians who have been captured from as far back as the French and Indian Wars to as late as last week. That's where all of this collective body of knowledge goes into. And there it's brought out into simulation. So the SEER program, which was never designed to be used to actually handle people or prisoners, somehow became the template for operations, as I understand it, in Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah. And this, all of this, as people may recall, this discussion just lately, although this has been a topic of conversation in Washington for some time, it was all in the context of the hearings for Michael Mukasey, who had been nominated to be the Attorney General. And the members of Congress were trying to get an answer from him to this question: did he believe waterboarding was a form of torture? Also, I guess we should point out that the use of this technique by the U.S. military is formally banned, but apparently it has been used by the CIA and many members of Congress, and I'm sure many Americans, and I think you would share that feeling, believe that it shouldn't be used at all by any American for any purpose as part of an interrogation. But what they were trying to do is to get Mr. Mukasey to say what he felt about this, and he didn't really seem to want to say, but part of all this was you were brought in to address, as someone who had some personal experience, this question of, is this or is this not torture? And you said in some fairly dramatic testimony, look, I've been there, and I can tell you this is not like drowning, it's drowning, and I felt I was being tortured, so as far as I'm concerned, this is torture.
Well, I think that that's absolutely right, and I think that where we're having a problem with this debate is that we're splitting hairs, and we've actually made this a debate. And there are many people who have far more credibility than myself. John McCain, Senator John McCain, for one, who was truly tortured. I'd read his debriefing when he came back from Vietnam. It's this extensive document. And he was held as a prisoner of war for 5 years in a North Vietnamese prison camp in the Hun, you know, and was tortured horribly. And so when he says that waterboarding is torture, you know, I only had to perform the procedure as a demonstration model and as, you know, in order to keep our people safe, including people like John McCain, who had gone through our school prior to his captivity in Vietnam. But this is one of the problems that we're having in America, is that this has been turned into a debate. And it truly is a black and white subject. As one Marine NCO says, you know, right is right and wrong is wrong. And on this particular point, I believe that it's wrong, and I made that very clear in the sense that all of this information that we use, these techniques that we use, if it's true that we're actually doing these things, we have actually taken those totalitarian techniques from that were collected from people who had been U.S. service members who were captured and tortured. That's where our body of knowledge comes from. And so we essentially are taking our enemy's tools and are applying them to captives of our own. Hmm.
This, I'm sure that this waterboarding is taken as a kind of a case study because it's one of the, because it has, we know that it has been used. It's actually got a long history, but it has been used recently. And that it's one of the worst things that we can think of that actually has been used. I'm sure that there are worse things that are done. But what it does is that I guess it gives an opportunity to have some exploration of a larger question, and that is, as I tried to say in making some introduction, the question being, all right, where do we draw that line between what we feel we can live with and what we can't?
You know, I wrote that down when you said that, what we can live with. And this is a huge debate within the military and the intelligence community right now, you know, Congress apart. the question that we have here is not so much can I slap him 25 times? Can I punch him in the stomach? Can I do these all of these, you know, calumnies, I call them, against the prisoner? The rules are very, very clear in the military, and they were laid down by General George Washington after he saw his soldiers who were captured slaughtered at West Point. And we do not abuse prisoners as a policy. And for some strange reason, now, since September 11th, that rule went out the window. And I don't personally believe that we're fighting a different war. I mean, we've had bigger wars. We've had higher stakes. And I've been dealing in counterterrorism now, actually, it's 27 years. And I don't believe that these tools are the first thing that we should have gone to. There are many, many, many shades of gray and finer areas that we have to go to where we don't have to get to phrases like that we can live with. Because once you discover that you are actually going to go to coercion, you're going to find out that the interrogator will generally always go to coercion, and very quickly. And he won't have the patience to actually extract the intelligence in the proper manner that would actually bring that captive or bring that operative over to our side. And that's what we really, our ultimate goal is to gain intelligence and to gain it on a basis of trust as to where perhaps we can actually use that person, whether we want to use them for propaganda purposes or run him back as an agent. That's an entirely different matter. But we don't have to actually go and use coercive techniques to get information.
Well, that, I mean, to me, gets at the question, how is it that you, and I know that this, you've also done this kind of work, how is it that you go about trying to get someone to tell you something or to cooperate with you when they don't want to, and when in fact they may have gone through training like the very like the SEER training that you're involved in, that is supposed to prepare them to be coerced and to resist coercion? I mean, how do you do that?
Well, I can give you a short story. There, the most successful interrogator in World War II on the side of the Nazis was an Air Force officer named Hans Scharf. And Hans Scharf never used the coercive method. He always used what we call the friendly technique, or a series of small tricks that he would use. But in for the most part, he co-opted the cooperation of the people he was assigned to interrogate by actually looking out for their welfare, by bringing up the subjects that they wanted to talk about, and by allowing them to go out and discuss what they want to discuss. Now, I've been working the Al-Qaeda mission since 1993, and I can tell you right now that one of the key hallmarks of the Al-Qaeda operative is they're very proud of what they do. And I'm talking about hardcore members who have actually been brought into the organization, not just the supporters. And for the most part, they will tell you what they will do. They will tell you what they intend to do. They will tell you about their philosophy and their doctrine and the day that they expect to go meet Allah. And these are things which a skilled interrogator, which the U.S. military now has taken away coercive techniques and are finding out that there's no impact on their ability to collect intelligence. A skilled interrogator will actually use these things, and they will allow the person to espouse. Now, if they've gone through some form of resistance training, they're going to be a little harder to deal with, but they're still human beings. And when you apply the proper tools and the proper sequence, and I don't mean, you know, coercive tools, when you know, perhaps it's just isolation, perhaps you'll have to use, perhaps it's discussion, perhaps it's, some of the other methodologies which are more classified, which don't involve actually physical harm upon a prisoner. Well, these methods make the prisoner want to become cooperative in the sense that right now these people believe what America does is torture people. And perhaps if there is no torture, we will have changed the stereotype on how they should cooperate.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Malcolm Nance. He's a counterterrorism and terrorism intelligence consultant for the U.S. government's Special Operations, Homeland Security, and intelligence agencies. He's director of Special Readiness Services International. He's a veteran of the Navy. He's a retired chief petty officer and has been working in the U.S. intelligence field for now well over 20 years. As I mentioned, one of the things that he did when he was in the Navy, he worked at the Navy's SEER school. That stands for help me out again here.
Survival, evasion, resistance, and escape.
Right. I have far too many pieces of paper here. and that, as we have explained, that part of the purpose of that was to prepare people for what they might encounter if they were taken prisoner. And as I said, you might have heard or read some of the testimony that he gave a little earlier this month on Capitol Hill in conjunction with the Mukasey hearings, where he testified and said very clearly what he thought about waterboarding, which was something that was, and I'm sure will continue to be, debated as an interrogation technique. Questions and comments are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Well, if for people who have to do this kind of work, is it, for example, for people who are in the military, who would be involved in interrogation,
yeah,
is it very clear, is it spelled out in the whatever kind of manuals they have and rule books and, you know, the stuff that they're given that says this is what you can do and this is what you can't? Is it spelled out very clearly what kinds of techniques are allowed and what are not, so that there would be no doubt in anybody's mind whether something was appropriate, approved, allowable under international law and under the military codes? Is it just, you would say, that there should be no doubt in anybody's mind what is allowed and what's not?
Well, I would have said that prior to the Abu Ghraib incident. The U.S. Army Interrogation Manual, which is the standard doctrinal manual for all the armed forces, clearly now prohibits and bans any abuse and humiliation of detainees. And again, as I said just the other day, General Casey, Chief of Staff of the Army, stated that he believes that they are making very, very good progress in Iraq, processing over 16,000 captives without the use of coercive techniques or any of the abuses that were seen in Abu Ghraib. Now, one of the problems that we have is once a senior commander or a civilian leadership has set the pace for what they expect you to do, you can see that the rules and standard operating procedures can go out the window quite fast, and that's what happened at Abu Ghraib. Individuals will always do acts on the battlefield which can be considered war crimes or which will be violations of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's once the chain of command itself has decided that, well, we'll allow these things with a wink and a nod because we want to take off the gloves, then that's where we find people who will literally throw the rule book out the window. And I believe that what's going on, and again, this whole debate in itself is a matter of honor. It is not just a matter of technique. Hmm. And we now have a stained honor. We know for a fact that people in the U.S. Armed Forces and the U.S. government have authorized torture at the highest levels. And now we have to reverse that. And the Armed Forces has taken that step due to the law that was passed last year. And they now no longer do this. And they will not allow that. And there have been murders that are being investigated by the Armed Forces. There have been deaths of captives due to the abuse by prisoner handlers in interrogation. The question now is, does the intelligence community fall under that umbrella? Hmm.
And you obviously believe it should.
Well, I believe that there's a place and a time for everything. And however, when you align it to torture, what you're essentially saying is that we are now operating by a different set of rules, and that these rules are now encapsulated in policy, and that policy allows us to take, compromise our moral high ground in order to show brutality or to demonstrate to our enemies that we have the capacity to be just as ruthless as they do. That is technically not how America has operated. Granted, individuals have done horrible things in our past, both in the intelligence community, the armed forces, and the civilian world. However, as a nation, we are the ones who set the guidelines for how our intelligence operatives and how our military operators in the field are supposed to behave. And if we allow ourselves to debase ourselves and go to the level of Al-Qaeda, and I always get the argument that, well, Al-Qaeda beheads people. Well, trust me. I mean, I've been studying that organization for 20 years and operating against them for almost as long. And we are not Al-Qaeda. We do not do what Al-Qaeda does. We can engage them on the battlefield. We can engage them in the covert world of clandestine world of intelligence, and we can bring them in. But when we descend to their level, we compromise ourselves because there's nothing to gain from that point. They expect us to do this. We are validating their worldview of what the United States and their intelligence agencies are, which is brutal, horrible thugs. And if they were not to meet that in interrogation, I think it would be much easier to break them.
We have a number of callers here, and I want to start to bring them into the conversation. Again, people can really help us, though, by trying to be brief. That way we can get in as many folks as possible. We'll start in with, we'll take them in the order they came in, starting in with someone in Urbana, and line number one. Hello.
Good morning. There's a lot of talk about waterboarding, certainly, but frankly, it's not clear to me, and I'm sure to a lot of people, just what is involved. What's a waterboarding session like? And from the victim's point of view, what are the sensations and what happens? I'll hang up with that.
All right. Well, that may well be a good question. I think the caller might be right that as much as it's been discussed and people have heard the term, perhaps there are some folks who would say, well, I really don't know what that is.
Well, that's an excellent question, and that was one of the key questions I was called. I was quite surprised to find that on Capitol Hill they didn't have a very clear idea of what this procedure was. Waterboarding is a very, very old torture, and its true name is the drowning torture. Many people have heard of it as the Chinese water torture or the being dunked in the barrel. It's a form of drowning. What they do, and I'll describe two versions of it. There's the one version that I saw at the F-21 prison in downtown Phnom Penh, which the Cambodian Khmer Rouge used during their genocide, and is a perfect replica. I mean, an exact model of the same waterboard that we use when we train our military service members. The waterboard is an slightly inclined platform, which you are strapped down and leather straps. In Cambodia, they use metal shackles. But you're strapped down in these straps from head to toe, so where your head can't move. It's back in an incline. And then you're watched by a professional team, doctor, psychologist, and an interrogator, and a strap-in, strap-out team. And then they pour very carefully controlled quantity of water in the area around your mouth and nostrils. And when you try not to breathe, they have ways of inducing you to breathe, and then water fills your sinuses. It fills your throat, and then they have several ways of making you gag to where you start to ingest the water into your esophagus, then down into the trachea, and you can feel the water pour in. The water doesn't stop, even when they're asking you questions. You can start feeling it enter into your lungs, and it starts to get a little painful at that point. But more to the point, you're trying to balance many, many different sensations. You're trying not to gag. You're trying not to drown. You're trying to get the water out of your throat. You're trying to spit it up. You're finding water is constantly being introduced. And then you have someone screaming questions at you. And you realize that this is an extremely unpleasant operation. At some point, usually within the 15 to 20 second range, I'd say, people go into hysterics. And when I mean hysterics, every muscle in their body starts to vibrate, and you try to break your bonds. And when you do that, that induces you to overcome your gag reflex again, and it allows more water to start entering your lungs. And you are in a very slow, controlled drowning. Because if left alone, your lungs are going to fill with water, and you're going to die. At the appropriate time, when they feel that they have the information they want, or they feel you're compliant enough, they de-strap you, roll you off the board, let you puke up and choke up the water. And then they start, they want to see if you're in a more compliant mood to answer questions. Most people, I can't say that I've seen anybody successfully resist it.
The question that comes up again and again, and the point that comes up again and again about using techniques like this or other things, and I'm sure that people would understand this, is that, and if you just imagine yourself in that circumstance, you're going to do whatever it takes at some point. The point's going to come where you're going to do anything to get them to stop, mm-hmm. and to do what you can to make sure they're not going to do that again. So the tendency, I think, is going to be to want to tell people what you think that they want to hear, and so that gets us to the ultimate question here: can you, as an interrogator, can you ever really trust information that is obtained by these kinds of methods?
I will tell you the official policy, the actual first words on the slide that we train all service members who are going through through training to resist torture, and the first words on that slide are: torture is not reliable. Because you will say anything. You will do anything to get that pain to stop. And anyone who's gone through it over a period of time, like, you know, the brave men who endured the tortures at the Hanoi Hilton and other North Vietnamese prison camps, they realized that there were limits to human endurance and that you had to create a battlefield, a battle space between you and your interrogator. And the amount of time you resisted, whether it was 1 second longer than the previous time, was the actual area that you fought him in. And the information that you gave, you may not have any idea what you've said under torture, because you know some tortures can quite literally take you out of your mind. And there are far more worse tortures than the waterboard, but the waterboard is absolutely up there with all the others. But you will say anything. You will do anything.
Let's talk with someone else. Champagne, line two. Hello.
Yes, I just want your chief petty officer, I want your reaction, because my reaction after being a JAG officer in the active duty and the reserve for 22 years and going to Charlottesville at the U.S. Army JAG School and studying law of war and being pretty much told back then that waterboarding and other, quote, coercive techniques was torture and violated the law of war. And now I hear the chief executive officer of this country, the leader of the free world, come before the media and the country and say we engage in intensive interrogation methods, but we do not torture. And then I hear people say that the mastermind of the 9/11 was probably a subject of waterboarding. And I become very disillusioned with the president and the vice president and how they're undermining the ideals of this country, as I learned when I was in the military. I liked your reaction to that.
Well, first, let me thank you for your service as a JAG officer, because I thought I'd never say this. I actually am a senior chief, but I thought I'd never say this, but the JAG Corps right now is the front line in restoring the honor of the military.
Yeah, all the TJAGs are trying hard. I agree with you.
I just think that you have officers like Colonel Couch, who was a hardcore Marine aviator. You know, his friend was killed on September 11th, was a pilot of one of the aircraft, and got his the person he was supposed to help defend and realized immediately this man had been tortured, been placed under coercion, and he would not go through with it. You know, it's unfortunate, because I would have thought that knowing myself and knowing what I know and all the experience that I was given from my father, who was also a master chief, if I had been ordered to a waterboarding team, I would have considered it immediately an unlawful order, and I would not have taken part in that procedure if I had been ordered to practice it on a prisoner in a coercive environment, because it's against the laws of war. It's against the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's against the U.S. Code. It's against the international human rights standards. And it's against the Geneva Convention. Right, violates Article 17 of the Geneva Convention, coercive and questioning, right off the top. And I personally couldn't live with that. And there are better ways to engage the enemy. I'll go out as a sniper on the battlefield. I'll fly a Predator drone. But I don't believe in the concept of an American torture. And again, as a JAG officer, I thank you for being now the front line in America's restoration of honor.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is Champaign County, and it's line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if you saw any clips from the debate last night, but McCain and I believe it was the Mormon guy. Sorry.
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney had a fracas about it. And Romney retreated under the fact that I don't want to give away the possibility of our using that technique, whereas I don't know if you saw it, but it was quite a scramble. But that's only really an aside anyway. But, you know, there's a bit of a we haven't done it. You did allow that exceptionally it was done. But I happen to know during the Vietnam era that Smith & Wesson made a fine trade in exporting variable transformers for the use of electricity in torture. It's not something that's new. We shouldn't be revisionist about it. That's one thing I wanted for you to note. The other thing is that I've heard, and I'd like to hear how you respond to this, that the Sears program, is that what it's called?
Sears, yeah.
Yeah, was actually reverse engineered. It was a place where people were taught how to torture. And I don't know if you feel like that you had any special knowledge of that or whether you can talk about it even.
Well, I can tell you this much. I recently learned that there was a manual that was created using our collective SEER procedure manuals, what we call processing manuals. And now, again, those manuals that we use to simulate the captive environment were a collective body of 50 years of torture knowledge from our enemies. And I enjoyed teaching that because I really wanted to show our servicemen and women that that's what's out there. This is what you can expect, and it's going to be unhappy, but your job is to return with honor and resist to your utmost. I understand that you're right. It was reverse engineered. Someone had, perhaps unauthorized from what I understand, had proposed to some government agencies that we take the SEER manuals and use all of that collective body of of totalitarian torture knowledge and apply it to handling prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. And that is a disgrace. If that's true, I personally think it's criminal.
Well, I'd like to, again, you're saying we learn those from our enemies. We actually also learned and had a vibrant trade back and forth with Latin America, where torture manual from Fort Benning's, Georgia, you know, was an accumulation of what we were teaching them, but it's also things that were done down there. It wasn't just our, quote, enemies that we learned it from. The other thing that didn't come up in the debate was, there was a big shouting match about this, but no one pointed out that the signing statement that Bush signed after the very vaunted successful passage of McCain's bill pretty much vitiates the whole notion of the bill. It basically says he can order it if he wants to. It's the imperial presidency. Thanks a lot.
Right, thank you. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, and we'll take some other callers. We're talking this morning with Malcolm Nance. He is a retired U.S. Naval Chief Petty Officer and has for now well more than 20 years been involved in doing counterterrorism and terrorism intelligence work for the U.S. government. He right now is Director of Special Readiness Services International, which is a Washington, D.C.-based anti-terrorism, counterterrorism consultancy supporting the intelligence community. And as we have mentioned, one of the things that he did while he was in the Navy, he was an instructor at the school that we've talked about in the survival, evasion, resistance, and escape program that they had to train service people for what they might encounter if they were taken prisoner of war or were taken hostage. And again, as we mentioned a little earlier this month, in connection with the hearings for the nomination of Michael Mukasey to be Attorney General, he did testify on Capitol Hill about waterboarding, because there apparently was some question in some people's minds about whether this procedure was torture or not. And he was there to say yes, as far as he was concerned, it was. He'd experienced it, and he said that it was. And he said very strongly he felt that it should not be used by anybody representing the United States. And we're glad to have him here talking with us this morning. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we'll talk next with someone in Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, having heard somebody just talking about bullying, and it was a guest on one of the focus call-ins, and she was talking about dehumanizing. It's not seeing people as one of the things that allows us to do this. I'm sitting here thinking and realizing that I've also seen clips of Christian preachers talking about the end times and how to bring them on, and you know, the Antichrist and all this stuff, and I'm thinking to myself, do our leaders, are they allowing this because they think that if you're a Muslim or if you're not Christian, that you're not human, or you're not, maybe that you're human, but you're not, you're going to go to hell anyway, so who cares? And even if our president isn't thinking in those terms, I'll bet you that there are people in the armed services, as there are elsewhere, who feel that way. And so that's one point. Another point is a friend just gave me the book Three Cups of Tea, and it's about it's a story of a climber in who fails to summit the second highest peak in the world, K2, in the northern Pakistan, and he gets lost coming down. He's been oxygen deprived. His formerly athletic body has been depleted by being at high altitude and all the efforts he's made. And he almost dies going off in the wrong directions, coming down the glaciers. And he's by himself. He's gotten separated from his group. And he ends up, fortunately, taking a wrong turn that takes him into a Pakistani village. And they take him in, and they take care of him, and they heal him, and they send him on his way. And he goes back, and the story's about his building a school for them, and then because he's a passionate person, getting involved in building bridges and more schools. And the title comes from his needing to learn how to honor the customs of the people that he's working with. And one of the things that, one of the themes of this story, which goes on over more than 10 years, is that if we do not honor people and their basic humanity, that we end up creating enemies. And some of the people say, you know, this is what we're seeing Americans doing on TV. And if I only saw that and didn't see you as this person who is caring about us and building schools and treating us and our religion with respect, then we would hate all Americans. But you make hope possible. And that's what we should be doing. We should be realizing that this goes beyond the question of whether it's honorable to torture somebody. And I perfectly agree with you that it is not. It also goes beyond and says we're just creating more people to hate us, giving more people reasons to not ever forgive us for what we as Americans are allowing to happen. Not just the military is dishonored. We as Americans are dishonored by allowing this to happen and allowing our president to do this.
If I could just comment there, that's very good. I'm a mountain climber, so I know I know what it's like to be up in the Karakoram and having three cups of tea as a honorific, as a guest of as a feeling of being a guest. Your point about dehumanizing is a very good one, and I don't believe that these are evil intentions in themselves. I think what's happening is that prisoners who are related to the Al-Qaeda organization are now considered non-persons. And I think it's more of an ideological bent politically in the way that they now view this war. I mean, we've dealt with far greater threats than the Al-Qaeda organization. The Soviet Union was running agents in the United States. We were pointing tens of thousands of nuclear weapons at each other. And operating on a set of gentlemen's rules for decades that still managed to allow us to do what we needed to do to win the Cold War. Granted, some of the people that we're dealing with now like to use high explosives in order to make their point, whether they hijack an aircraft and use it as a cruise missile or whether they try to acquire an atomic weapon. The the point that we have here is that I don't need, as an intelligence professional, I don't need 10,000 more recruits coming into this battle who are now age 5, 6, and in 10 years will be more than willing to come and fill the ranks of that organization. There is a way of dealing and treating prisoners to the point where they will become, perhaps they will learn something about the United States that will allow them to realize the errors of their ways. One of the biggest mistakes that we've made in Guantanamo Bay was not allowing the prisoners to have any material, any medium, except a Quran. And as many people who operate in the Middle East in my career community know, that when you have a prisoner who has nothing left, they turn to God. And that it's the same for our service members, and it's the same for theirs. And if they have a Quran, they have a source of strength, as opposed to putting them in an environment, which I would have done, where instead of being given a Quran, which I would have given them at certain points of the day, I would have allowed them full media except for the news. I would have allowed them to watch Britney Spears on television and all the other silliness that we have. I would have allowed them to socialize, but I would have made sure that the only time they had any contact on a religious basis other than their services was in the presence of moderate or liberal imams who will try to show them the error of their ways. These men kill children and feel that it's an honor to have had that child die within their jihad, when in fact the Al-Qaeda organization is a cult. There are many facets of how they do operations which no Muslim, when you explain it to them, would ever countenance. However, our image in the Middle East for Muslims, where I live, it's superseded by all the actions that we take. And to the point where people on the street will actually say, well, Al-Qaeda does behead your soldiers in Iraq, but you deserve it because you did Abu Ghraib. We don't understand where that comes from, but I understand where it comes from. And I have to work within that area to get those people to come to my worldview.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We're moving into our last 5-6 minutes, so I hope that you won't mind if I go into another. And this is someone in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Okay. Don't get me wrong here. I'm really against torture and even waterboarding. I think it's a horrible thing, and I'm ashamed of our country for participating in it. But let me play the devil's advocate for a minute. Mm-hmm. Are there conditions under which it is allowed? For example, you have an 8-year-old daughter. She's kidnapped. And you know she's going to be sexually assaulted and then killed. You have someone who knows where she is. Would you engage in torture?
No.
I'll take my answer out here.
It's a good question. I get this question quite a bit, and I want to clear this up. How do you know you have the right man? I mean, how do you know? I always get the ticking time bombs in there.
Yeah.
How do I know I have the man that knows every component of this plan? Unless they're absolutely the most amateur organization in the world, the guy who's driving the bomb doesn't know, you know, that he has an atomic bomb. Maybe he thinks he has a high explosive bomb. He doesn't know, perhaps, who all the ringleaders are. Even members of the 19-man team on 9/11 didn't know all the operational details. Now, granted, 9/11 was an operation where if we had truly applied all of our intelligence resources and listened to a few of our domestic intelligence agencies like the FBI agent in Milwaukee and in Phoenix, we would have broken that plot with almost 6 months to spare. But to immediately go straight to coercive techniques, you don't know if it's going to work. Many, many of these jihadis, and they're within their own sphere, they are men of honor. And I say that with great respect because I have to respect my enemy. But they want to die, and they view it as an honor to go along with their enemy. So they will just laugh through the interrogation, or they'll turn into, as we say, turn into the Quran and quote surahs to themselves and just run the clock out.
So this, as you say, and this is the ticking time bomb scenario, this is always the thing that it's the the case study example people always say, okay, you have the situation where you have a terrorist organization that's put an atomic weapon in the middle of a major metropolitan area, and you have a guy, and you believe that this person knows where the bomb is. Mm-hmm. So, and it's either, you know, it's do, what do you do? Do you do whatever it takes with the idea that you're going to prevent the explosion of the bomb and the death of a lot of people? But it sounds like, if from what you're saying, actually that kind of scenario, as you say, the fact that you're up against it like that, and you have one person, and this is your one opportunity to foil this plot, it's actually not, the way things happen in the real world, it's not a particularly realistic scenario.
It's not, and you know, as I often try to make it very clear, made it clear to the Congress that the TV show 24 is not an intelligence community documentary. It is a fantasy, and what we have is a misinformed public that believe that these fantasy scenarios are the real world. It's not like that at all. In fact, you can probably gain more intelligence forensically by applying a CSI type process to a bomb factory or a command center or even an individual's room, and gain more intelligence about what he was planning by using electronic, you know, backtracking surveillance and things like that, going through phone records, than you would by coming through and trying to torture this man. You're only going to harden his resolve, and he's going to be looking for ways in order to resist you. You got to try the soft method first. But I don't think coercion is going to work with the type of operatives we're talking about.
Yeah, and so just again to take the example of the caller, if this you put yourself into that situation where here what you're talking about is the welfare of some individual who is very close to you, and you have someone who you think has information that would help you rescue them from something very terrible happening. Mm-hmm. You feel that you could hold yourself back from using highly kinetic methods, as they say.
Well, I mean, you know, there are other techniques which are not as coercive. However, I think, and this is why we have teams of psychologists on our interrogation teams. You have to evaluate the individual first. You have to determine whether this is an individual who is a hardcore jihadi who may have received some resistance training, or do you just have a guy who's a flunky who's bragging and is really lying? And to tell you the truth, law enforcement and methodologies are far more effective in getting the information that you want, and this is what most military intelligence interviewers do, interrogators do. They go out and they feel out the subject very quickly, but how do you know you have 5 minutes? If you found a document, that document is probably more important than the individual at that point. Mm-hmm. There are ways to process that information and backtrack it, but it would have to be in a scenario where you would already have 99% of the information. At that point, you just don't know. There's just far too many unknowns to determine whether hurting this man, or as I've heard people recommend, hurting their family in front of them. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, when they threatened his son, he said, "Oh, I would love to have my son join me in paradise. Please kill him."
Hmm. Let's take at least one more caller here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Oh, hello. With regard to this ticking bomb scenario that you've just been talking about, I would say that the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was exactly that. This was a man who was known to be not a minor player, but the mastermind of 9/11, and I think that it was reasonable for the interrogators to believe that he may well have had knowledge of a plot to kill thousands or tens of thousands of Americans. And so I think whatever they needed to do to get information from him was justified. And from what I've read in the papers, the waterboarding was successful. It was only after that he did give up information.
And that's correct. He did give up information. Now, I don't know to what extent he gave up information, but here's another factor. I don't know if any of that's true. From the things that I've seen that he gave up, it appears that he gave up practically every useless plot that was in his head or that he had heard, including the one where they were evaluating using a blowtorch to cut the cables on the Brooklyn Bridge. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was a very, very well-educated man. He saw himself as a global master terrorist. He was actually a braggart. But a resistor who gets tortured in this way is going to quickly figure out that there's certain information he can give up, that will be of no effect to his organization, and he'll learn methodologies to mask the areas that he doesn't want to give up. One of those ways of masking it is what we call turning into pain. If you're pushed yourself or you've been pushed by an interrogator to hurt you to a certain extent, you can't say anything if you're in pain. Therefore, you will say things that are innocuous and inane once that pain lessens. The more he gets tortured, the better he gets at it. And we've processed thousands of people in Iraq and hundreds of people out of Guantanamo Bay, and there is almost certainly a virtual Al-Qaeda seer school, because I've seen interviews in Arabic and Al-Arabiya and Al Jazeera in the Middle East where these men talk for hours about, in great detail, every little thing that's happened to them and how they endured it. And it's the key there, how they endured it, that is going to allow the Al-Qaeda organization to become far more resilient than they are now.
We have just about a minute. Maybe just one last thing you could talk about. Yet another reason for not using torture is not so much the effect it has on the victim, but it has on what it has on the perpetrator.
Well, inflicting that kind of punishment, if you're using it as a punishment, is very hard. It was hard enough doing it in training. I mean, we had situations where we had men and women who were going through that and were getting processed that way, where you really had to harden yourself and realize that it was for the better good. However, for someone who's using it in a coercive environment, who has no problem with seeing a person go through hysterics or die under their hands, and we have had murders in the armed forces and in the intelligence community, then you're going to have to look at yourself in a completely different light. And I don't believe September 11th justifies any of that. I was a victim of September 11th. I was at the Pentagon. And I find people who are furthest away are the ones who are more than willing to do the things that are un-American.
Well, there we will have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Malcolm Nance. He's a more than 25-year veteran of the U.S. intelligence community's Combating Terrorism program. He's a combat veteran, retired chief petty officer in the U.S. Navy. He served as intelligence collections operator, cryptologist, interrogator. He's director of Special Readiness Services International. That's a Washington, D.C.-based anti-terrorism and counterterrorism consultancy organization. Mr. Nance, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.